everyone, and we want to welcome you to a very special, super hefty holiday episode of the 13 Club podcast. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Miranda.
I'm Kim.
And thanks for joining us today.
We're here to talk about some spooky things for Christmas. I was reading something the other day, and they were like, actually, for old literature, the spookiest time of year is Christmas, not Halloween.
I think I saw something similar. I think, like, it's funny, I was kind of inspired because I saw this, like, meme. It was, like, a Twitter screenshot going around. It was like, let's bring back holiday ghost stories.
Like, yeah, hell
I'm,
yeah,
like, all about it. I think, like, really, there's no better time to embrace it than the year 2019. Am I right?
Oh, yeah.
And we, I know yeah. we, like... Oh, sorry.
No, I just said, oh, yeah, again.
You're good. We talked about it a little bit last episode. I know Kim has something, like, super extremely scary to talk about in the next episode, and we said it was going to be in the next episode, which would be this episode, but then we realized it was a holiday. So you'll get Kim's super scary research in the episode after this one. Just in case.
It gave me more time to, like, not have to listen to the audio files, so.
Really cut yourself a break there. I'm sure you're super disappointed we're not talking about that one today.
I'm gonna make my husband literally sit with me to do that. It freaks me out.
I literally cannot wait to hear what you've got. But I'm glad we decided to do some, like, holiday-themed stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is our first holiday together as a podcast. Or rather, yeah. It's our first holiday that we're really observing. We've missed out on Halloween in the past and some other things. So this is kind of special.
Yeah. It's a 13 Club Christmas.
I was going to say, it's kind of a 13 Club Christmas miracle. we're
That's
back.
Fine. Just add miracle.
Add miracle at the end. Do you want to go first this time, or would you like me to start?
I can go first. That's fine.
Okay, I mean, you don't have to.
So, my topic was given to me, basically. Shout out to my sister.
Ooh.
She sent me an Instagram post, which was just, like, this artist rendition and, like, a little summary of who she is. And I was like, oh, damn, I love her already. Mm-hmm. And then I decided to just write 3 pages about her, like, after looking up a bunch of things. Mm-hmm. And most of my stuff comes from the Smithsonian's interviews with various Icelandic people. And there's a little bit from Vice magazine as well, and we will put that in the blog post.
Yes. Oh, that's a bit of business we can catch up at the end, is the state of the blog posts.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway.
Yeah. The state of the blog. That's like the State of the Union.
Yes. We're going to call in like 30 journalists and a bunch of cameras. The state of the blog posts.
So, have you ever heard of Grilla?
No. How is it spelled?
G-R-Y with an accent to indicate that it's a short I sound, L-A.
Huh. Grilla, okay. No, I've never heard of her before. I assume it's a her.
So, yeah. So, it's not, like, horrifically scary, but it's super cool. So, I wrote, how to describe Grilla? She's been described in a number of ways, sometimes as simply an ogre. Sometimes she is said to be a monstrous female being with hooves. Ooh. In some stories, she looks like a sheep who walks like a human. In others, she is a troll. Sometimes she has 300 heads and a beard. Or she has blue eyes in the back of her head. Ooh. One description portrays Grilla as having 15 tails, together bearing 100 balloons filled with children.
What?
So, Grilla comes from Iceland's hinterlands, where she lives in a cave. She is a force to be reckoned with who will attack your towns and scoop up all of your bad children so that she may bring them home to make soup out of. In the earliest accounts of her, which are from the 13th century, one poem reads, "Here comes Grilla down in the field with 15 tails on her." Another, Down comes Grilla from the outer fields with 40 tails, on her back a sword, knife in her hands, coming to carve out the stomachs of the children who cry for meat during Lent.
Oh my god, this is so rad. I'm sorry.
I'm excited about it too. More early poems about Grilla describe her as being a parasitic beggar who walks around asking parents to give her their disobedient children. Her plans can be thwarted by giving her food or by chasing her away. Originally, she lives in a small cottage, but in later poems, she appears to have been forced out of town into a faraway cave. So Iceland observes Jól, which is another word for Yule.
Okay.
Which is a midwinter celebration for gathering and feasting. It is the basis for Christmas. And then I wrote, in quotation marks, don't at me. Because it is the fucking basis for Christmas, all right? I'm sorry, but it absolutely is.
But, actually, historians say... Just kidding. I agree with you.
Yeah, like, where's... Yeah.
Everyone listening, I hope you can imagine me pushing my glasses up my nose as I say, actually,
Jesus Christ, literally, according to Terry Gunnell, the head of the folklorist department at the University of Iceland, the earliest celebrations included elves, trolls, and other magical and spooky creatures believed to inhabit the landscape. Sometimes these figures would visit in the flesh as masked figures, going around to farms and houses during the season. And I'm like, don't do that to me.
Don't do...
Them walking around and, like, just hanging out, visiting, like, your house. Like, don't...
Oh, you don't want visitors? No unexpected guests?
No. It says that they... The magical and spooky creatures believed to inhabit the landscape would visit in the flesh as masked figures going around to farms and towns during the season.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
That just seems spooky to me.
Too much?
Yeah, just like them wandering around with masks on. Like,
yeah, that's a very eerie mental image. Okay, I can get behind that. I can get behind you here.
So Gunnell says she was certainly around in 1300, but she was at the time not directly associated with Christmas, but more as a threat that lived in the mountains. She was at that time more of a personification of the winter and darkness. She controlled glaciers, volcanoes, and earthquakes. So Grilla had a few husbands. One of them she ate. The second one she killed. Gunnell explains she may have been the first feminist in Iceland. her third husband is described as a lazy oaf who chills out in the cave while she does all the work.
So she can do better.
She has a cat. She could do better. So she has a cat, the giant Yule cat. The Yule cat eats people, and they have a preference for children, but most specifically for people who are not wearing new clothes. So, brand new socks and long underwear were crucial during the Icelandic Yule times. Because, if you don't have new underwear, the Yule cat just might come and get ya.
What if this is, like, secretly the origin for, like, the socks?
Stockings?
Socks. Oh, I was gonna say socks people get at Christmas. Like, I got socks again. Like, well, you should be grateful because now Gorilla's not gonna get you.
Yeah, the Yule cat's not gonna come and eat ya.
Yeah.
So, Grilla had many children with her husbands, but the only ones that are ever talked about are the 13 sons, who are called the 13 Yule Lads. They have plenty of nightmares to offer you as well. So, let's go over them, but not by name, because my pronunciation, I can't even pronounce the word pronunciation, so there you go. Gully Gawk, he steals foam from buckets of cow's milk. Stubby, he's short and steals food from frying pans. Spoon Licker, he licks your spoons. Pot Scraper, aka Pot Licker, steals unwashed pots and licks them clean. The Bowl Licker, he steals bowls of food from under the bed, which apparently back in the old days, Icelanders used to sometimes store bowls of food there.
Okay.
The door slammer. He stomps around and slams doors, keeping everyone awake. The skyr gobbler. He eats all of the Icelandic yogurt. The sausage swiper. He just really loves stolen sausages. And then we get a little weirder with the window peeper, who is just literally the original Peeping Tom. Like, he just likes to watch.
Hmm.
And then you have the door sniffer.
Ooh.
He has a huge nose and an insatiable appetite for stolen baked goods. Then you got the meat hook. He goes around with a hook just to snatch any meat that might be left out. Then you have the candle beggar, who stalks children so that he can steal their candles. And then... yeah, like, why?
Please don't. Okay.
So then my favorite is the sheep coat clawed. He has long, stiff legs that he cannot bend, which is quite a shame, because he just wants to sneak up on sheep and suckle their nipples.
Ooh.
Yeah, no, I'm serious.
No, thank you.
Yeah. So, as expected, they all kind of look creepy. Like, as if Gorilla could have any normal-looking children. Though, in the 20th century, they sort of got a Santa/Seven Dwarfs-style makeover. Just to make them more, like, accessible. And they got red and white outfits. They also started leaving gifts instead of stealing, which is not very punk rock of them.
They really got, like, a whole brand makeover.
Yeah, they did.
Do you think Disney bought the rights?
Yeah, I was thinking the exact same thing.
No way, seriously?
I wouldn't be surprised if they're, like, we're gonna see, like, some kind of, like, Yule Lads movie from Disney.
Coming soon to a theater near you.
Yeah. I just want to see how they handle the sheep coat clawed.
Oh, of course.
The Santa-style makeover was also largely largely gone now, thanks to the National Museum of Iceland, who is pushing to preserve the original Icelandic legend. They now look more like, as Gunnel describes them, aged Hell's Angels without the bikes.
Rad.
Yeah. I'm okay with it. It's better than Santa. It actually wasn't until the 19th century that Gorilla became tied to Christmas. The Yule Cat and her lads became prominent Christmas figures, but she was intentionally left out. One popular Christmas song actually includes her death. Never fear, though, because our holiday queen can never die, and she is still all over Iceland. It is popular for people to make costumes of her during the holiday time, which are absolutely worth a Google.
Oh.
Icelandic children's illustrator, whose name is Pilkington, says that children are truly terrified of Gorilla. I've visited play schools to demonstrate drawing skills, and if I draw a Gorilla, then two or three terrified children have to leave the room because it's too strong for them. This is living folklore.
That's so cool.
Though in the 1700s, he would have been breaking the law, because at that time, it was illegal to scare children with Gorilla.
Oh, what? I mean...
Yeah, you just can't do it. Just stop hurting children with this story. Knock it off. Magnus H. Skarpidson, who is the headmaster at the Elf School, which is a Reykjavik-based institution devoted to Icelandic folklore. It's literally like a school about literally elves. They explain that mystical beings like Gorilla are really common in Icelandic culture. A 1998 study found that 54% of Icelanders believe that elves and hidden people exist.
That's...
So they're really into it there.
Yeah, I feel like I've heard other, like, podcasts cover, like, Hildafolk and, like, little people... Maybe not so much in, like, Iceland. I think maybe they just talk about it, like, in Europe in general. But, like, it's really incredible how many cultures still, like, embrace these other creatures, I guess. I don't know what the respectful term is here. But, like,
yeah.
I don't want to call them, like, fantasy creatures, per se. But, like, I think it's, yeah, it's really cool.
And then the last, like, little example I have about how intensely involved they are in these concepts. Icelanders are so concerned with supernatural entities that there was an 8-year-long debate between government environmentalists and elf believers spanning from 2007 to 2015 when the construction of a new highway threatened to destroy a 50-ton elf church.
What?
And the elves won, and the church was saved.
Well, good.
Yeah.
It's about time.
Yeah. That's just, like, an overview on Grilla, so I hope you enjoyed it.
No, that was really... I've, like, literally never heard of this character. It, like... It's not the same thing by any means, but it's sort of, like, I guess, analogous to, like, maybe a female Krampus, sort of.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, is very interesting. And she sounds much scarier, to be honest.
Yeah. I love her. I support her. I think she could kick Krampus's ass.
Probably.
I like the Krampus, but... I mean, I don't know. I found a new love.
I think it's, you know, it's time to embrace some new Christmas monsters, and I think Grilla is a prime candidate.
My mom actually just came back from Iceland.
Oh.
My parents decided that they were going to take a little trip for my dad's birthday because he's, like, about to retire, so he's trying to use up his vacation.
Right.
And he always wanted to see the Northern Lights, so he went and he saw them, and my mom, I was talking about this to her today, and she was like, yeah, they believe in fairies there. I talked to people, and they believe in fairies.
I hope she brought you back something cool and fairy-related.
If she didn't, I mean, I don't know what to say.
I mean, I guess I'm just gonna have to disown her.
Yeah, I asked her if she had seen anything about the Yule Lads when she was there, and she said no, but I don't know. I'm going to ask my dad, because maybe he noticed more than she did.
Keep us updated. I need to know.
Oh, well. I'm like, now I'm just like, I really wish somebody had got me some Yule Lad crap from Iceland. give me a mug. Give me something.
Well, now you've got initiative to maybe make your own trip someday.
Oh, I've always wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's another reason to go, because apparently, according to Matt Jones, Icelandic peanut butter is the greatest thing on earth. And,
really?
He had gotten a whole bunch of Icelandic peanut butter, and he was going to bring it home. And they made him throw it out at the airport.
Fucking customs.
Yeah, because they said it was a liquid.
Dude, fucking hate TSA. Leave this in the podcast. I need everyone to hear me be so angry at TSA. Well, in the spirit of what we were talking about earlier, which is like Christmassy ghost stories, I pulled out a Christmassy ghost story that I'm going to read to you guys. It's a short story from, I found it on, like, from The Guardian, I guess during the month of December in, like, 2013, they were doing, like, Christmas ghost stories every week. And this one is called Dark Christmas by Jeanette Winterson. So I hope you guys settle in, grab a mug of something, and enjoy it. We had borrowed the house from a friend none of us seemed to know. High Fallen House stood on an eminence overlooking the sea. It was a square Victorian gentleman's residence. The large bay windows looked down through the pines towards the shore. 6 stone steps led the visitor up to the double front door, where a Gothic bell pull released a loud, mournful clang deep into the distances of the house. Laurel lined the drive. The stable block was disused. The walled garden had been locked up in 1914 when the gardeners went to war. Only one had returned. I had been warned that the high brick wall enclosing the garden was unsafe. As I passed it slowly in the car, I saw a faded notice falling off the paint-peeled door. Do not enter. I was the first to arrive. My friends were following by train, and I was to collect them the next day, and then we would settle down to Christmas. I had driven from Bristol, and I was tired. There was a Christmas tree roped on the top of my 4x4 and a trunkload of provisions. We were not near any town, but the housekeeper had left stacked wood to build a fire, and I had brought a shepherd's pie and a bottle of... Oh, I should have looked up how to pronounce this. Maybe you'll know.
It's okay.
Rioja. Rioja. It's a wine. A bottle of Rioja for my first night. The kitchen was cheerful enough once I got the fire going and the radio playing while I unpacked our festive supplies. I checked my phone. No signal. Still, I knew the time of the train tomorrow, and it was a relief to feel that the world had gone away. I put my food in the oven to heat up, poured a glass of wine, and went upstairs to find myself a bedroom. The first landing had three bedrooms leading off it. Each had a moth-eaten rug, a metal bed, and a mahogany chest of drawers. At the far end of the landing was a second set of stairs up to the attic floor. I am not romantic about maids' rooms or nurseries, and there was something about that second set of stairs that made me hesitate. The landing was bright in the sudden way of a late sun on a winter's afternoon. Yet the light ended abruptly at the foot of the stairs, as though it couldn't go any further. I didn't want to be near that set of stairs, so I chose the room at the front of the house. As I went to bring up my bag, the house bell started to ring, its jerky metallic hammers sounding somewhere in the guts of the house. I was surprised, but not alarmed. I expected the housekeeper. I opened the door. There was no one there. I went down the steps and looked round. I admit I was frightened. The night was clear and soundless. There was no car in the distance, no footsteps walking away. Determined to conquer my fear, I walked around a little. Then, turning back to the house, I saw it. The bell wire ran along the side of the house under a sheltering gutter. Perhaps 30 or 40 bats were dangling upside down on the vibrating wire. The same number swooped and swerved in a dark mass. Obviously, their movement on the wire had set off the bell. I like bats. Clever bats. Good. Now supper. I ate. I drank. I wondered why love is so hard and life is so short. I went to bed. The room was warmer now, and I was ready to sleep. The sound of the sea ebbed into the flow of my dreams. I woke from a dead sleep in dead darkness to hear... What? What can I hear? It sounded like a ball bearing or a marble rolling on the bare floor above my head. It rolled hard on hard, then hit the wall. Then it rolled again in the other direction. This might not have mattered except that the other direction was upwards. Things can come loose and roll downwards, but they cannot come loose and roll up unless someone... That thought was so unwelcome that I dismissed it, along with the law of gravity. Whatever was rolling over my head must be a natural dislodging. The house was drafty and unused. The attics were under the eaves where any kind of weather might get in. Weather or animal. Remember the bats. I pulled the covers up to my eyebrows and pretended not to listen. There it was again. Hard on hard on hit on pause on roll. I waited for sleep, waiting for daylight. We are lucky, even the worst of us, because daylight comes. It was a brooding day that 21st of December, the shortest day of the year. Coffee, coat on, car keys. Shouldn't I just check the attic? The second set of stairs was narrow, a servant staircase. It led to a lath and plaster corridor barely a shoulder width wide. I started coughing. Breathing was difficult. Damp had dropped the plaster in thick, crumbling heaps on the floorboards. As below, there were three doors. Two were closed. The door to the room above my room was ajar. I made myself go forward. The room was under the eaves, as I had guessed. The floor was rough. There was no bed, only a washstand and a clothes rail. What surprised me was the nativity scene in the corner. Standing about 2 feet tall, it was more like a doll's house than a Christmas decoration. Inside the open-fronted stable stood the animals, the shepherds, the crib, Joseph. Above the roof, on a bit of wire, was a battered star. It was old, handmade in a workmanlike but not craftsmanlike sort of way, the painted wood now rubbed and faded like pigments of time. I thought I would carry it downstairs and put it by our Christmas tree. It must have been made for the children when there were children here. I stuffed my pockets with the figures and animals and left quickly, leaving the door open. I had to set off for the station. Stephen and Susie could help me with the rest later. As soon as I was out of the house, my lungs felt clear again. It must be the plaster dust. The drive to the station was along the coast road. Lonely and unyielding, the road turned in a series of blind bends and tight corners. I met no one and I saw no one. Gulls circled over the sea. The station itself was a simple shelter on a long single track. There were no information boards. I checked my phone. No signal. At last the train appeared distantly down the track. I was excited. Memories of visiting my father as a child when he was stationed at his RAF base gave me a rush of pleasure whenever I traveled by train or come to meet one. The train slowed and halted. The guard stood down for a moment. I watched the doors. It wasn't a big train, this branch line train, but none of the doors opened. I waved at the guard who came over. I'm meeting my friends. He shook his head. Train's empty. Next stop is the end of the line. I was confused. Had they got off at the earlier stop? I described them. The guard shook his head again. I noticed strangers. They would have boarded at Carlisle, asked me where to get off. Always do. Is there another train before tomorrow? One a day, and that's your lot, more than anybody needs in a place like this. Where are you staying? Highfallen House. Do you know it? Oh, aye, we all know it. He looked as if he were about to say something else. Instead, he blew his whistle. I needed to get a signal on my phone. I drove on past the station, following the steep hill, hoping some height would connect me to the rest of the world. At the top of the hill, I stopped the car and got out, pulling up the collar of my coat. The first snow hit my face with insect insistence, sharp and spiteful like little bites. I looked out across the whitening bay. That must be Highfallen House, but what's that? Two figures walking on the beach. Is it Stephen and Susie? Had they driven here after all? Then as I strained my eyes against the deceit of distance, I realized that the second figure was much smaller than the first. They were walking purposefully towards the house. When I arrived back, it was nearly dark. I put on the lights, blew the flyer into a blaze. There was no sign of the mysterious couple I had seen from the hill. Perhaps it had been the housekeeper and her daughter come to make sure that everything was all right. I had a telephone number for Mrs. Wormwood, but without a signal I could not call her. The snow was thickening in windy swirls. Relax. Have a whiskey. I leaned on the warm kitchen range with my whiskey in my hand. The wooden figures I had brought down from the attic were lying on the kitchen table. I should go up and get this table. I don't want to. I bounded up the first set of stairs using energy to force out unease. At my bedroom, I put on the light. That felt better. The second set of stairs stood in shadow at the end of the long landing. I felt that constriction in my lungs again. Why am I holding onto the handrail like an old man? I could see that the only light to the attic was at the top of the stairs. I found the round brown switch. I flicked down the nipple. A single bulb lit up reluctantly. The room was straight ahead. The door was closed. Hadn't I left it open? I turned the handle and stood in the doorway, the room dimly lit by the light from the stairs. Washstand, nativity, clothes rail. On the clothes rail was a child's dress. I hadn't noticed that before. I suppose I had been in a hurry. Pushing aside my misgivings, I went in purposefully and bent down to pick up the wooden nativity. It was heavy, and I had just got it secure in my arms when the light on the landing went out. Hello? Who's there? There's someone breathing like they can barely breathe. Not faint, struggling for breath. I mustn't turn around because whoever or whatever it is behind me. I stood still for a minute, steadying my nerve. Then I shuffled forward towards the edge of light coming up from downstairs. At the doorway, I heard a step behind me, lost my balance, and put out a hand to steady myself. My hand gripped something wet. The clothes rail. It must be the dress. My heart was overbeating. Don't panic. The light switch, bad wiring, strange house, darkness, aloneness. But you're not alone, are you? Back in the kitchen with Risky, Radio 4, and pasta boiling, I examined the dress. It was for a small child, and it was hand-knitted. The wool was smelly and sopping. I washed it out and left it hanging over the sink to drip. I guessed there must be a hole in the roof, and the dress had been soaking up the rain for a long time. I ate my supper, tried to read, told myself it had been nothing, nothing at all. It was only 8 p.m. I didn't want to go to bed, though the snow outside was like a quilt. I decided to arrange the nativity. Donkey, sheep, camels, wise men, shepherds, star, Joseph. The crib was there, but it was empty. There was no Christ child, and there was no Mary. Had I dropped them in the dark room? I hadn't heard anything fall, and these wooden figures were 6 inches tall. Joseph was wearing a woolen tunic, but his wooden legs had painted putties. I pulled off the tunic. Underneath, wooden Joseph wore a painted uniform. First World War. When I turned him round, I saw there was a gash in his back, like a stab wound. My phone beeped. I dropped Joseph, grabbed the phone. It was a text message from Susie. Trying to call you. Leave tomorrow. I pressed call. Nothing. I tried to send a text. Nothing. But what did it matter? Suddenly, I felt relief and calm. They had been delayed, that was all. Tomorrow they would be here. I sat down again with the nativity. Perhaps the missing figures were inside. I put in my hand. My fingers closed round a metal object. It was a small iron key with a hoop top. Maybe it was the key to the attic door. Outside, snow had fallen on snow. The sky had cleared. The moon sped above the sea. I had gone to bed, and I was deep asleep when I heard it clearly. Above me. Footsteps. Pacing. Down the room. Hesitate. Turn. Return. I lay in bed, eyes staring blindly at the blind ceiling. Why do we open our eyes when we can't see anything? And what was there to see? I don't believe in ghosts. I wanted to put on the light, but what if the light didn't come on? Why would it be worse to be in darkness I had not chosen than in darkness I was choosing? But it would be worse. I sat up in bed and pulled back the curtain a little. The moon had been so bright tonight, surely there would be light. And there was light. Outside the house, hand in hand, stood the still and silent figures of a mother and child. I did not sleep again till daylight, and when I slept and woke again, it was almost midday, and already the light was lowering. Hurrying to get coffee, I saw that the dress was gone. I had left it dripping over the sink, and it was gone. Get out of the house. I set off for the station. There was an air frost that had coated the trees in glittering white. It was beautiful and deathly. The world held in ice. On the road, there were no car tracks, no noise, but the roar and drop of the sea. I moved slowly and saw no one. In the white, unmoving landscape, I wondered if there was anyone else left alive. At the station, I waited. I waited some time until past the time, until the train whistled on the track. The train stopped. The guard got down and saw me. He shook his head. "There's no one," he said. "No one at all." I thought I would cry. I took out my mute phone. I flashed up the message. "Trying to call you. Leave tomorrow." The guard looked at it. "Happen it's you should be leaving," he said. "There's no more trains past Carlisle now till the 27th. Tomorrow was the last, and that's been cancelled. Weather." I wrote down a number and gave it to the guard. "Will you phone my friends and tell them I'm on my way home?" On the slow journey back to High Fallen House, I filled my mind with my departure. It would be slow and dangerous to travel at night, but I could not consider another night alone. Or not alone. All I had to do was manage 40 miles to Inchbarn. There was a pub and a guest house and remote but normal life. The text message kept playing in my head. Had it really meant that I should leave? And why? Because Susie and Stephen couldn't come? Weather? Illness? It's all a guessing game. The fact is, I have to go. The house seemed subdued when I returned. I left the lights on, and I went straight upstairs to pack my bag. At once, I saw that the light to the attic was on. I paused, breathed. Of course it's on. I never switched it off. That proves it's a wiring fault. I must tell the housekeeper. My bag packed, I threw the food into a box and put everything back in the car. I had the whiskey in the front, a blanket I stole from the bed, and I made a hot water bottle just in case. It was only 5 o'clock. At worst, I'd be in Inchbarn by 9 p.m. I got in the car and turned the key. The radio came on for a second, died, and as the ignition clicked and clicked, I knew that the battery was flat. 2 hours ago at the station, the car had started first time. Even if I had left the lights on. But I hadn't left the lights on. A cold panic hit me. I took a swig of the whiskey. I couldn't sleep in the car all night. I would die. I don't want to die. Back in the house, I wondered what I was going to do all night. I must not fall asleep. I had noticed some old books and volumes which I had explored downstairs yesterday, assorted dusty adventure stories and tales of empire. As I sorted through them, I came across a faded velvet photograph album. In the cold, deserted sitting room, I began to discover the past. High Fallen House, 1910. The women in long skirts with miraculous waists, the men in shooting tweeds, the stable boys in waistcoats, the gardening boys wearing flat caps, the maids in starched aprons. And here they are again in their Sunday best, a wedding photograph. Joseph and Mary Locke, 1912. He was a gardener, she was a maid. In the back of the album, loose and unsorted, were further photographs and newspaper cuttings. 1914. The men in uniform. There was Joseph. I took the album back into the kitchen and put it next to my wooden soldier. I had on my coat and scarf. I propped myself up in two chairs by the wood-fired range and dozed and waited and waited and dozed. It was perhaps 2 o'clock when I heard a child crying. Not a child who scraped his knee or lost a toy, but an abandoned child. A child whose own voice is his last hold on life. A child who cries and knows that no one will come. The sound was not above me. It was above the above me. I knew where it was coming from. I put my hands over my ears and my head between my knees. I could not shut out the sound. A locked-up child, a hungry child, a child who was cold and wet and frightened. Twice I got up and went to the door. Twice I sat down again. The crying stopped. Silence. A dreadful silence. I raised my head. Footsteps were coming down the stairs. Not one foot in front of the other, but one foot dragging slightly, then the other joining it, steadying, stepping again. At the bottom of the stairs, the footsteps paused. Then they did what I knew they would do with all the terror in my body. The footsteps came towards the kitchen door. Whatever was out there was standing 12 feet away on the other side of the door. I stood behind the table and picked up a knife. The door swung open with violent force that rammed the brass doorknob into the plaster of the wall. Wind and snow blew into the kitchen, whirling up the photographs and cuttings on the table. I saw that the front door itself was wide open, the entrance hall like a wind tunnel. Holding the knife, I went forward into the hall to shut the door. The pendant metal lantern that hung from the ceiling was swinging wildly on its long chain. A sudden gush lurched it forward like a child's swing pushed too high. It fell back at force against the large semicircular fanlight over the front door. The fanlight shattered and fell round my shoulders in shards of sharp rain. Flicker, buzz, darkness. The house lights were out. No wind now, no cries. Silence again. Glass hit in the snow-lit hall. I walked out of the front door and into the night. At the drive, I turned left and saw them, the mother and child. The child was wearing the woolen dress. She had no shoes. She held up her arms piteously to her mother, who stood like stone. I ran forward. I grabbed the child in my arms. There was no child. I had fallen face down in the snow. Help me. That's not my voice. I'm on my feet again. The mother's ahead of me. I follow her. She's going towards the walled garden. She seems to pass through the door, leaving me on the other side. Do not enter. I tried the rusty hoop handle. It broke off, taking a piece of the door with it. I kicked the door open, and it fell off its hinges. The ruined and abandoned garden lay before me. A walled garden of 1 acre used to feed 20 people, but that was a long time ago. There were footprints in the snow. I followed them. They led me to the bothy, its roof patched with corrugated iron. There was no door, but the inside seemed dry and sound. There was a tear-off calendar still on the wall. 22nd December, 1916. I put my hand in my pocket, and I realized that the key from the nativity was there. At the same time, I heard a chair scrape on the floor in the room beyond. I had no fear anymore. As the body first shivers and then numbs with cold, my feelings were frozen. I was moving through shadows as one who dreams. In the room beyond, there was a low fire lit in the tiny tin fireplace. On either side of the fire sat the mother and child. The child was absorbed playing with a marble. Her bare feet were blue, but she did not seem to feel the cold any more than I did. Are we dead, then? The woman with the shawl over her head looked at me with deep, expressionless eyes. I recognized her. It was Mary Locke. She nodded at me, or not at me, at some other me in some other time. I don't know. Her gaze went to a tall cupboard. I knew that my key fitted this cupboard and that I must open it, and I did so. A dusty uniform fell out, crumpling like a puppet. The uniform was not quite empty of its occupant. The back of the faded wool jacket had a long slash where the lungs would have been. I looked at the knife in my hand. Open the door. Are you in there? Open the door. I woke to blinding white. Where am I? Something's rocking. It's the car. I am in my car. A heavy glove was brushing off the snow. I sat up, found my keys, pressed the unlock button. It was morning. Outside was the guard from the train station and a woman who announced herself as Mrs. Wormwood. Fine mess you've made here, she said. We went into the kitchen. I was shivering so much that Mrs. Wormwood relented and began to make me coffee. Alfie fetched me, she said, after he spoke to your friends. There's a body, I said, in the walled garden. Is that where it is? Said Mrs. Wormwood. At Christmas 1914, Joseph Locke had gone to war. Before he left for Flanders, he had made a nativity scene for his little girl. When he came back in 1916, he'd been gassed. They heard him, climbing the stairs, gasping for breath through froth-corrupted lungs. His mind had gone, they said. At night in the attic, where he slept with his wife and child, he leaned vacantly against the wall, rolling the child's marbles up and down, down and up, pacing, pacing, pacing. One night, just before Christmas, he strangled his wife and daughter. He left them for dead in the bed and went out, but his wife was not dead. She followed him. In the morning, they found her sitting by the nativity, her dress dark with blood, his finger marks livid at her throat. She was singing a lullaby and pushing the point of the knife into the back of the wooden figure. Joseph was never found. Are you going to call the police? I said. What for? Said Mrs. Wormwood. Let the dead bury the dead. Alfie the guard went out to see my car. It started first time, the exhaust blew and the white air. I left them clearing up and was about to set off when I remembered I had left my radio in the kitchen. I went back inside. The kitchen was empty. I could hear the two of them up in the attic. I picked up the radio. The nativity was on the table as I had left it, but it wasn't as I had left it. Joseph was there, and the animals and the shepherds and the worn-out star, and in the center was the crib. Next to the crib were the wooden figures of a mother and child. The end.
Too spooky.
The spook. Too. I really, I picked that story because it, like, I realized, like, I read several, like, really old-timey short stories. I thought maybe I would do, like, a classic one, like, a forgotten one. But, this one really grabbed me because, I got, like, kind of sucked in by the mystery of, like, what happened to the previous family. And I really liked the setting as well.
Yeah. The way the author writes is also really nice.
Mm-hmm. They're, like, the way that they choose to describe things is really, like, I mean, I assume it is for everyone, but, like, for me especially, it was very, like, easy to, like, imagine things.
Mm-hmm.
So, I hope that it gives some of you guys a nightmare about a...
marbles being rolled on the floor.
And a, like, stinky, wet yarn nightgown.
Mm. It's very appealing.
Everyone's fave.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That was awesome.
Yeah, I hope you liked it.
And this is, I guess, a perfect time to say that we are going to start having blog posts again. And if you want to read this one yourself.
Yes.
Or know more about the author, you can find more info at our new website, which is 13club.com. And that's XIII club.com.
Yes. We are... the domain is purchased. Things are getting into motion. We're going to be moving our old posts from previous episodes over to this new domain. So please bear with us for a short time while we get everything lined up. But that's going to be the new official home, I guess, so to speak, of the podcast.
Mm-hmm. You can find everything about us that you would need from 13club.com.
And maybe something you don't need. Who knows?
Yeah, like, probably plenty that you don't need. But just any kind of links that you were looking for. Like, I heard about this on the podcast, and I just kind of don't want to listen to the episode again. I just want to know what it was. You can find it there. Mm-hmm. And also links to contact us or donate if you feel so inclined.
Yes, we didn't mention this in our last episode because we're kind of rusty, but we do have a Ko-Fi account set up. Our current goal is to raise enough money for a year of SoundCloud Premium, just so we can continue to...
Yeah, SoundCloud Pro.
Yeah, mm-hmm. SoundCloud Pro. So we can continue to, like, host our things. That's our goal. It's a modest one, but we definitely need your help to achieve it. So if you feel like it, we would be grateful. We're always super grateful for all of you guys. Thank you for all of your kind comments. And if you like what you've heard, please give us a shout out, give us a like, leave us a review, especially on iTunes. That's really helpful to us.
Yeah, we need those. We need those iTunes reviews.
Yes, that's the best Christmas present you could get for us.
Yeah, some iTunes reviews. Yes, please. Would be nice.
Do you have anything else?
Also,
ooh, cool.
Yeah, if you want to contact us, send us a story, or request a topic be covered on an episode, you can send us an email, which is ask13club@gmail.com.
Yes.
13, again, Roman numerals. Mm. We're all about the Roman numerals here.
It's consistent. Consistency. Yeah. Please reach out to us on all of our other social medias. We have a Facebook page, which is the 13 Club Podcast, or the 13 Club. We have Instagram, which is at the 13 Club. And we have Twitter, which is the same. So we can be found in all three of those places.
And we like to post, like, spooky images every day.
And
so if you just need a little spook, just a small one, we got you.
And
my dog is just going nuts.
It's okay. She's an honorary member. I personally like to occasionally post a, like, lighthearted spooky thing. Just because, you know, you can't let it get too dark. But those are great places to also, like, interact with us and keep in touch. And we do love hearing from you guys. So I hope this episode gave you some thrills and some chills. I hope you learned something. And
yep. And we will see you next time for my weird 1990s. I'm hinting. 1990s creepy phone calls.
Oh fuck. Okay. Oh my god. I can't wait. Yeah. Oh no. I'm already upset. Okay.
All right.
Yep.
Bye, guys.
Happy holidays!